Hello, and thank you for joining us for this virtual policy forum on the Brussels effect, how EU and UK tech policy impacts Americans and American companies. While much of our conversations around tech policy here in the States have focused on various debates in the US on issues like Section 230, data privacy, or competition policy, the reality is one of the many benefits of the internet is the way it has given rise to global connections. America has been a leader in innovation technology, and particularly in the internet age. Europe, however, has had a much different approach traditionally than the US when it comes to how to deal with questions of technology policy. In many cases, this has been seen as two conflicting point of views, one that's more regulatory and one that's more permissionless. That is part of what has given rise to many of the American companies compared to the number of European tech companies. However, recent European policies like the Digital Markets Act, the Digital Services Act, and GDPR have perhaps changed the debate a little bit. Increasingly, American companies may find that they're dealing with significant issues of compliance around these European laws, and they may have spillover effects into US tech policy, either via informal elements such as implementation more globally or through the conversations in the policy debate. I'm excited to be joined today by experts on issues related to speech, competition, and other technology policy issues from both sides of the Atlantic to have a discussion on this topic. Additionally, I'm excited to be joined by many of you who are watching us live, and I'd like to remind you that you can submit your questions for the panel either via the webpage, Facebook, and YouTube, or on Twitter using the hashtag Cato Technology. My panelists today include Evelyn Aswad, who's the Herman G. Kaiser Chair in International Law and a professor of law at the University of Oklahoma College of Law. She's also a member of the Oversight Board. I'm next joined by Matthew Feeney, who is the head of tech and innovation at the Center for Policy Studies. Before joining CPS, Matthew was a scholar here at the Cato Institute, and his writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, City AM, and many others. And then finally, I'm joined by Matt Sinclair, an economist and technology and media consultant, and the author of a recent study on the UK competition policy for the Center for Policy Studies. So to start with, Matt Sinclair, I'm going to turn to you. As I mentioned, Europe has generally been perceived as having this more regulatory approach to technology policy, but something about these recent actions, such as GDPR, seem to have had more of an impact on Americans and American companies. Can you give us a brief rundown of just what are some of these recent tech policy actions in the EU and the UK that the US should be, that Americans in the US should be aware of for how they're impacting American tech companies?
So you've got, I think, about three categories here. You've got some big measures that are already in place, like the GDPR that really reshapes global data protection, like the New Deal for Consumers, which is doing that for consumer protection, particularly for e-commerce platforms. You've then got two big measures coming in, the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act, which have been kind of run in parallel through the legislative process. And then you've got stuff coming down the street, like the AI Act. Those two big measures that are coming in now are, I think, where the conversation is most active. The Digital Services Act is an online safety measure, but incredibly broad in its ambitions. You're doing everything from sort of structuring how platforms have to do notice and action when people believe they've seen illegal content on a platform, through to requiring platforms to create an online repository of every ad that they run, through to requiring them to do reports on systemic risks to fundamental rights created by their platforms. The Digital Markets Act may be even more ambitious, requiring interoperability so that you can have Siri on your Android phone, you can have a message sent from Signal to WhatsApp, requiring huge publication of data about prices and conditions through the ad tech stack, and requiring All sorts of regulation of the commercial terms that platforms provide to their users, requiring that they show that business users are getting what's called a fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory standard. That's a standard that's often used in utility regulation, like telecoms regulation, for example. So this is going to change the digital sector in Europe from being largely a commercial sector to being a regulated industry, where it's how it kind of safeguards its consumers and how it interacts with business users and its commercial terms are subject to an enormous amount of additional scrutiny from particularly the European Commission.
Thank you. Matthew, the UK left the EU's regulatory circle via Brexit. We've seen that the UK has also been undertaking several quite significant actions when it comes to the future of technology and tech policy. Can you tell us a bit more about the UK's tech policy post-Brexit? Has it been more or less regulatory than its counterparts on the continent? And what might proposals like the Online Safety Bill or the DMCC mean for Americans and American companies?
Right. Well, it's I think worth pointing out that the UK is in a very some might argue an enviable position of dealing with a regular a comparatively blank slate when it comes to regulation post-Brexit. The Prime Minister's rhetoric has been pretty good on technology. You'll hear time and time again from British ministers and government officials that the UK is a good technology hub. And there have been a lot of reassuring signs from press releases and white papers and other documents along those lines. However, I think what a lot of civil servants and government officials found out after Brexit is that deregulation is actually quite difficult. And there have been numerous attempts to find a way in order for government agencies to find and remove regulations that were in place when the UK was a member of the European Union. While the British government rhetoric on technology has been good, I think unfortunately some of the legislation and regulation that has come since Brexit are taking the UK in the wrong direction. The two pieces of legislation I'd highlight are one is the Online Safety Bill, which we'll probably talk about later on in the discussion, which I think is definitely going to have a major effect on American companies and will also affect American users of popular internet platforms. The other is a digital markets piece of legislation that Matt Sinclair wrote a paper on. But that piece of legislation, I think, goes beyond what I think you see in many parts of Europe by empowering a regulator to hamper a lot of what goes on in pretty vibrant and robust markets. Something else I'll mention is that the CMA, the British equivalent of the FTC, has in the last year issued a number of rulings that I think ought to concern a lot of Americans and those interested in investing in or working with American companies. One was telling Facebook that it couldn't acquire Giphy. More recently, though, was the CMA's blocking of Microsoft's acquisition of Activision. That acquisition is being rethought through, and Microsoft have reproposed it. But something I will mention is that the EU, which the UK left, their competition regulator greenlit that acquisition. So I'd say, in summary, that the British government has good rhetoric when it comes to technology, but the legislation it's been proposing should worry Americans and those interested in a vibrant global technology sector.
Well, as you mentioned, Matthew, I'm sure that several of those proposals we'll get into a bit more of the specifics in just a bit here. Evelyn, I want to turn to you. While oftentimes when we're talking about the impact these proposals may have on companies, we're thinking about terms around formal compliance and the cost, for example, that many companies put out in complying with GDPR. But there are also informal elements that may be impacting Americans as well. I was wondering if you could tell us how American tech companies have been enlisted to become the enforcers of European norms around speech, and particularly around hate speech.
Yes, sure. And first, let me start by thanking Cato for hosting this very important event. I'm speaking today in my capacity as a law professor, and I've done quite a bit of research on this issue. And to answer your question, two examples come to mind. The first is in 2016, the European Commission, together with Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Microsoft, issued a voluntary code of conduct on countering illegal hate speech online that required the removal of any hate speech as it was defined by the EU. Since that time, other US companies have joined, including Snapchat. So the definition of hate speech in this voluntary code is tied to actually an EU framework on hate speech that applies to nation states. And it starts out defining hate speech, I think, using pretty standard elements, but there are some pretty large exceptions. So it defines hate speech as anything that's public speech that rises to the level of incitement to violence or hatred and directed against particular groups. But as you can see, it bans not only violence, but speech that incites the feeling of hatred, which is beyond an act of violence or an act of discrimination. It also bans atrocity denial, which really goes beyond the global standard for hate speech, which would only ban atrocity denial where it's linked to near-term harm. And it also allows banning speech even if it would not disturb the public order and if it would merely be insulting. So the code states that US companies are supposed to be in the lead in fighting this type of hate speech online, and that they have to have procedures to receive notifications that this speech is online, and to react within 24 hours to a majority of these notifications. And then the EU publishes reports publicly to see how they're doing. And I think this raises real questions that we should be concerned about and be discussing in the US about how voluntary was this code, right? Were these companies pressured into this? Did they face the regulation and therefore entered into these types of voluntary arrangements? Should democracies be forced to follow their appropriate legal procedures when regulating speech rather than leaning on private companies? And of course, a law, or excuse me, in this case, a voluntary code of conduct that prizes removals in 24 hours can incentivize removals at the cost of more judicious examination of the speech that is at stake. So that's one example. Another example where US companies have been enlisted to become enforcers of European hate speech norms is a law in Germany called the NetzDG law, which took full effect in 2018 and required large social media companies to develop procedures to receive complaints about hate, about illegal speech, and to remove it within very short time periods. Companies that didn't comply faced very big monetary fines. And illegal speech was defined and pegged to the German legal code, penal code, which includes a ban on, for example, blasphemy, on insults, etc. So this law, similarly, and now it was the force of law, not a voluntary code of conduct, this law incentivizes removals and privatizes the enforcement of German national law by US private companies. I think these are items that we need to be particularly cognizant of and be discussing, particularly as both the EU definition of hate speech and German national law departs from some basic protections on freedom of expression that the U.S. has espoused at the international level in UN treaty law. So those would be the two that I put on the table to start our conversation.
I know in our conversation later on, we'll get into a little bit more of what are some of those differences in norms, both legally and culturally, between the U.S. and Europe when it comes to some of these speech questions. I want to turn back to kind of the global context of this debate we're having. Earlier this week, we saw Senator Cruz send a letter to Lina Khan criticizing the FTC's apparent cooperation with EU officials around issues like DMA and DSA that he mentioned were specifically appearing to target American companies, and that non-American companies were not, you know, on the same receiving end of regulatory scrutiny from these European laws. Similarly, when it comes to debate about online safety, we've seen this kind of unique dynamic where U.S. policymakers often point to what's going on in the U.K. or Europe, and U.K. and European policymakers often point to what's going on in states like California and Utah. I was wondering if any of you could speak a bit to how are all of these debates around tech policy and around the potential impact of these laws influencing each other between US, UK, and EU policy? And are there any particular areas where we've seen perhaps the rise of the European regulatory approach on American companies be more or less concerning for consumers or innovators?
We, Matt, if you look at the,
Matt, I'll let you go first.
I think if you look at the proposals that were put out for new competition laws in Congress, they're really strikingly similar to what's being done in Europe. If you just you add up and look across the different bills coming from Klobuchar and others, they look like the DMA and DSA to an incredible degree. And so I think that the EU law, clearly there is this process of the EU inspiring legislation in the EU. At the same time, I think a non-trivial part of why this is happening in Europe at the moment is because there is a sense that a signal has been sent from the US administration that this is almost welcome, where in the past they might have pushed back. So whatever's going on with Senator Cruz, I sort of think the message is more day-to-day message that European policymakers think they're getting from US representatives and from the US administration, and you know, Lina Khan would be a good example of that, is that that this is almost welcome in the US. And you know, it's not that it's written and says this law applies to US companies, but what it does is it's written saying it applies to companies with this kind of market cap, this number of European users, or in the case of the UK, that the regulator will come up with its own criteria, its own list of companies. But again, they will be the very largest tech companies, and those are overwhelmingly, not entirely, but overwhelmingly American headquartered. And so I think it has consequences for Americans through inspiring US policy, but then also because this is going to put a huge burden on US tech companies. Again, there's been a huge amount of effort going into complying with these regulations and not into the rest of their work, not into making those services better for US consumers, not into making them more competitive in order to succeed globally. So I do think that there is a significance beyond Europe to what's going on here and how much more draconian this regulation is becoming.
Jen, if I might, your question prompted me to think about what I've seen with online speech legislation. I think lawmakers across the Western liberal democratic world are understandably oftentimes hesitant to discuss a lot of the online speech proposals they have because they don't want to be accused of running a censorship regime or forcing private companies to moderate content necessarily. However, what I've seen with the online safety bill, because it's been in the works for years and years at this point, is that some lawmakers elsewhere in the world, like America, have grabbed onto some of its ideas and run with it and already got almost to the finish line with their own bills before the British have passed the online safety bill. And you have this interesting dynamic of British and American lawmakers flying across the Atlantic to speak to each other, policy advocates from both countries citing each other, saying, well, if the liberal British are doing this, it can't be that bad. Or here, the fact that you'll have members of the House of Lords, for example, talking about what lawmakers in Utah might be proposing suggests that at least in the English-speaking world, there's a degree of credence you can have if you can point to another country that's doing something along the same lines, or at least issuing those same proposals. What I think shouldn't be forgotten, though, is that more authoritarian countries will probably play the same game, which is when they want to crack down on speech in their own countries, they can say, well, this isn't that different to what the British and the Germans, for example, are doing. So, you know, don't freak out. And that would be a disappointing dynamic to have. But something that I think is worth keeping an eye on is that because these legislative proposals would affect, as Matt said, the same collection of mainly American companies, you're finding that there's a lot of not just cooperation, but discussion amongst lawmakers around the world.
I want to turn back. Evelyn, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in. This very interesting, you know, conversation has caused me to think about three themes that I think are also important for us to put on the table. You know, the issue of transparency when governments lean on tech companies, whether it's the U.S. government leaning on its own U.S. tech companies to do certain things behind closed doors or leaning on them in other fora. I think the issue of transparency is extremely important, and this is why there's such a push by civil society to get tech companies to be transparent about when that happens, but also governments. The second theme is, you know, what happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas anymore, right? When Europe passes these types of laws, there are knock-on effects. They become standards that others seek to implement. So with regard to the NetzDG law in Germany that I was talking about, a big free speech commentator, Jakob Mashingama, noted that within a few years of that law, there were 13 other countries that passed similar laws, five of which are countries that Freedom House rates as not free at all. So you can see very quickly how attractive when Western democracies pass laws restricting speech, how quickly that can move to other very problematic regimes. And another aspect to the influence these laws have, I think we should be thinking about, is many platforms like having global speech rules. So if they have to do something to appease Europe, that becomes sometimes an incentive or one of many incentives for them to make their entire speech rules around the world reach that new kind of lower standard for the protection of speech. And that affects, of course, Americans, but really people throughout the world.
Thank you. And I kind of want to build on some of what you brought up in your response there, Evelyn, but also really go back to some of what you mentioned earlier when discussing how American companies have been enlisted to become the enforcers of some of these European norms around speech. I think oftentimes we think of the US and Europe and the UK as having very similar cultures around a lot of issues like speech or legal systems or whatnot, but there are some very unique differences. I know many Americans take heart in the fact that they can perhaps rely on the First Amendment to protect them from some of the government and concerns that you just raised, for example, Evelyn. But I was wondering if, and I'll start with you, can you discuss how the US and the European and even the kind of global norms from, say, the UN differ on issues such as speech and why that matters?
Yeah. Well, I've written kind of two articles in this space, one comparing the First Amendment with UN norms on freedom of expression. And, you know, I actually found that they're more similar than one would guess at first, in that both systems, in order to restrict speech, require the regulator to pass a three-part test. The speech must not be improperly vague. It must be the restriction must be to further a legitimate public interest, and the burden or restriction on speech must be narrowly tailored. The UN uses the phrase least intrusive means. The US uses the phrase least restrictive means. Now, I think people can argue about whether those rules are applied more stringently in the US or UN, and that would be a fair argument to have. Although I did look at 10 years of UN analysis and interpretation by UN free speech monitors and found them to be quite similar when compared to US cases. Europe as a region has a different approach to speech that comes from its regional human rights charter and its regional human rights court. I wrote an article with the former UN free speech expert, David Kay, comparing the European regional approach to speech to the UN approach. And we found that, again, while Europe applies that same three-part test, it does so in the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights in a way that is much less rigorous than in the US or UN system. So for example, words that would be viewed as improperly vague in the UN or US system would pass the test in before the European Court. The legitimate public interests are more vast in the European system. So for example, banning blasphemy is considered an appropriate legitimate public interest in the European court jurisprudence, but is not in the UN system. With regard to narrow tailoring, the court only applies a proportionality test where it balances various factors and does not enforce a least restrictive means test, which certainly narrows the occasions in which speech bans are permissible. So I did find these quite significant differences. And I think it matters because we end up with US companies being pressured, whether through voluntary codes of conduct or through national legislation, to do things that are inconsistent with the UN's global minimum standards for protecting freedom of expression. And I think that's a big problem, particularly when you think some people conflate UN global standards with, you know, regional or European standards, and they may think they're living up to international standards, but really the global standard is from the UN. And the United States has called on all its companies in its operations, domestically and abroad, to respect the minimum human rights standards in UN human rights instruments. And again, as I mentioned, because these companies often have an incentive to globalize their rules, if one region forces them or incentivizes them to lower their protections for speech, that can affect their rules that apply to everyone in the world. So I think that's why it's very important to keep clear, you know, the difference between European regional approaches to speech and global minimum protections for speech.
Thank you. Matthew or Matt, anything to add to that?
Recently coming out with the Digital Services Act and the Online Safety Bill that kind of go beyond that picture Evan's describing as well, which is the first is that they are going from regulating illegal content to in varying ways and to varying degrees regulating content that isn't illegal, right? So requiring platforms to, whether it's sort of specifically for young people or more generally, requiring them to regulate activity that is harmful. I think the second is that they're not just kind of enlisting platforms to take action on certain kinds of content which they have deemed illegal or indeed deemed harmful. It's requiring platforms to go out there and do their own analysis of the risks that they are that content is creating on their platform. The EU calls this systemic risk. The UK is requiring risk assessments and then acts to mitigate that. So it's so in terms of kind of enlisting these platforms to be the censors, it goes further than sort of saying, okay, here's what we want you to censor. It's we want you to come up with a strategy to sort of moderate content on your platform, and then you will give us a report, give us these transparency disclosures, you'll tell us about the complaints you're getting, etc. You'll have trusted flaggers in the centre of the EU, and we'll tell you under the threat of enormous fines whether you're doing it well enough. And so I think it's going a stage beyond just saying here is these categories of content we think are illegal that should be controlled. It's saying here are these broad categories of problem online that we want you to go out there and identify and then mitigate.
If I could jump in on that point, everything Matt said is correct, but I think what viewers should consider is that with legislation like the Online Safety Bill, the drafters, unfortunately, I think, have overlooked a lot of the nuance that goes into content moderation. So, for example, the online safety bill outlines a whole host of legal content that firms will nonetheless have to consider in their content moderation decision making. But oftentimes it's about the content absent a lot of the context. So, for example, bullying content. Well, bullying content can be a video filmed by a student on a mobile phone that is shared around a social media site to humiliate the victim. But the same video can be used by an anti-bullying charity to highlight the kind of harms that they're trying to mitigate through their work. And what I think is a problem is, even if you do agree that there are a bunch of legal harmful pieces of content out there that the government should try to prevent children accessing, I would disagree with a lot of that, but let's take that as given. Nonetheless, one of the unintended consequences of this kind of legislation is that very helpful content that deals with difficult issues like eating disorders, suicide, that actually require a lot of nuance, will be hampered. And that will affect Americans, because as we've said before, a lot of these regulated companies will be American. And it's just too costly for even big tech companies to dedicate so many resources just for very strict compliance in a relatively small island nation off the coast of Europe.
You know, when we talk about a lot of these issues, we talk about the impact they will have on large companies, on folks that people think of as kind of these global tech giants. But we're also seeing that in many cases, laws like the GDPR, we know, has had an impact on startups and small and micro companies. I'm going to combine my last question with a question from Jake in our audience, which is, how will U.S. startups react to kind of these looming threats of regulation, and particularly startups that may be rapidly growing? You know, what are the impacts, not only on large tech companies, of this kind of emerging, more regulatory conversation in Europe, but what might we expect from some of the smaller players as well?
I think the first thing that every particularly as you say, fast scaling startups are going to think about is my service, is my business model durable to what this regulation would require if I succeed? Will you be able to, as your platform grows, accommodate the requirements for interoperability between messaging services? Just to give one sort of very specific example from the Digital Markets Act, because what that's kind of doing, that interoperability requirement, it's saying that you need to be able, these services need to be able to interact with one another. But what that does in practice is it requires them to standardize. And so what it does in practice, I think, is it makes it harder for platforms to differentiate themselves. And if you're asking, how can a fast scaling, what will a fast scaling business be thinking about? So what extent are we going to be forced into a kind of one size fits all policy where we have to build our platform kind of the same way as everyone else, because they all have to be interoperable. They all have to meet a lot of the same requirements for kind of how they treat content. It is going to make digital services a bit more samey. It kind of happens inevitably when you have this kind of degree of regulatory intervention. They've also got to plan for a lot of cost. I think that's where GDPR is the kind of canonical example here. Yes, the requirements here do scale with the scale of the platform, but that's not entirely true. You know, the online safety bill, I think in particular in the UK, will be costly for all kinds of platforms that aren't, you know, giants, right? And I think a final area is it will affect the digital platforms they interact with, right? It might change the services that they use as business users and affect the ability of those digital platforms to do deals with them, to interact with them in various ways that are part of how they grow. So I think startups are going to have to think about this at a deep strategy level, like, how is this going to shape our ability to build a distinctive platform at a global scale? And I think you're going to think about that both in terms of context, current regulation, but also to our earlier discussion, what happens if these EU and UK rules start to become a global norm?
Yeah, Jen, I don't know if I could quickly add that if it's an American startup, well, the online safety bill says that to be in scope, you have to have a significant number of British users, or the UK has to be a target market for your service. So if you want to avoid its regulations, you can either just not do, make sure you don't have a significant number of British users, or don't target the UK for your services. Which would be unfortunate, I think, for British consumers. But more to the point, though, I think it would empower large market incumbents that do feel as if they can weather the regulatory storm. The fact is that although the big Silicon Valley giants always get mentioned in these discussions, we should remember that legislation like the Online Safety Bill is going to affect tens of thousands of services, many of which have nothing to do with social media. And that, I think, is where we'll see many of the unintended consequences.
To turn to some of those questions around unintended consequences, we have an anonymous audience question about encryption and about the impact, particularly that the UK Online Safety Bill could have on encryption and what some of the unintended consequences there might be. We've seen already that certain companies, such as certain Meta apps and Signal, have threatened to leave the UK if this bill becomes law. What does the reality of something like this look like? How should policymakers be aware of what these consequences could be in terms of the ability, in terms of the availability of certain services in certain markets? And is this something you think we might see more of? We've seen, you know, consequences from Canada's C18 regarding journalism. Do you think that we'll see this action continue on if the Online Safety Bill becomes law?
I'm happy to talk about the encryption part of the question. For those who don't know, the Online Safety Bill would empower Ofcom, which I guess broadly speaking is the American equivalent of the FCC, to issue notices to particular services, asking them to use accredited technology to scan private messages for child sexual exploitation and abuse material. Now, although social media is often discussed in the context of the Online Safety Bill, services like Signal and WhatsApp, encrypted messaging services, are covered under the bill. And the use of the two words, you know, private messages, has been freaking a lot of these services out for understandable reasons. If you are enabling end-to-end encryption, you, the service, cannot scan messages for that kind of content. And I think, you know, WhatsApp and Signal have taken a principled stand saying that they would, haven't said it explicitly, but have hinted very strongly that they would rather exit the UK market rather than weaken their own security measures. It would be possible for them to do that in the UK narrowly. I wouldn't worry if I was, for example, an American WhatsApp user about the Online Safety Bill, but depending on how WhatsApp goes about a British exit, it could be pretty devastating. Something that I think a lot of Americans don't appreciate because it's not as widely used, but WhatsApp is ubiquitous in the United Kingdom. It is how government ministers communicate, it's how civil servants talk to each other, it's how businesses run, it's everywhere. And people all around the world communicate with British citizens as well. So it would be pretty devastating. It's been very frustrating because literally hundreds of cryptographers and computer science and policy analysts have been telling the government that this is a mess. But the latest version of the bill, which is expected to pass in a few weeks, still includes it. So we're sort of in uncharted territory here. There's still time for the government to fix it, but I haven't seen any suggestion that they're going to seriously do it.
And Jen, the second half of your question is about media sector, right? So This really starts in Australia. So the News Media Bargaining Code in Australia basically says that any digital platform that, broadly speaking, links to news has to do a deal with the news media groups to pay them. That's obviously looks pretty attractive politically to a lot of governments, because they're sitting there thinking, well, this is a way we can reward a politically important local stakeholder at the expense, at least in immediate terms, of a big American company. And so it's spread like wildfire. So you get this in Canada, then you get this in you get it achieved by a different route in the EU and the UK. So both the EU and the UK say that platforms need to do business on fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory terms. But what is fair and reasonable non-discriminatory is going to be settled by the regulator, kind of implicitly assumes that there's some kind of price paid. And they're going to make it difficult for platforms to walk away from that deal, it looks like. So I think the huge risk here is that what these laws are doing under the kind of cloak of being a competition measure is they're establishing a mechanism to reward almost any sort of vested interest by saying the digital platforms need to give you internet money, and it's the reality is this is money. This is going to probably shift the terms against possibly consumers, possibly advertisers, and it becomes a kind of form of digital tax. But I think because of the way it's been done, it hasn't aroused kind of US opposition the way outright digital services taxes have. But it is, in many functional ways, it's taxing, Google or Facebook to give some money to News Corp or other media groups. It's just being done via regulation and via regulators, with more or less kind of parliamentary involvement, depending on which country you're looking at.
So we have time for one more audience question, and I'm going to pull Alex's question, which is about the EU's recent mandate on USB-C charging ports and the anticipated mandate on replaceable batteries for personal electronics. I think his specific question is, how can we expect these regulatory measures to affect the design choices of US manufacturers, but more generally, what are some of these other kind of topics that we're seeing the EU give very prescriptive regulations on that your average American consumer may not be aware of?
So it's where you see some degree of consumer frustration, right? So look, is there some degree of consumer frustration out there about sort of Apple having its own charging standard? Sure. Is there some degree of complaint from people from sort of third-party manufacturers? Absolutely. But what this, of course, does is it again enforces standardization. And so it's going to mean that future progress in charging tech is going to be done a lot more by committee. I don't want to oversimplify, yeah, it's a simplification, but it is going to stand, they are going to increasingly get involved in this and other areas and make it a more bureaucratic process to build new services. And the really big example of this that is coming, down the road is AI regulation. To be in a world where you have a whole, process required in companies to decide, are our AI systems high risk or not? But then also for peaks of platforms developing AI services for other companies to use, are we providing the tools necessary for our customers who might be providing what are deemed to be high risk services? This is things like, credit checks, things like facial recognition and biometric checks. If we're doing that, if our service is being used in that way, we've got these layers of requirements. They're going to sit on these, what they're called foundational AI models. And so there's a whole range of areas like this where it's almost become a much more kind of creating this bureaucratic process for technological change. And at the same time, every problem under the sun, you include, if people are eating too much fatty food, you start regulating the digital advertising market. It's becoming this kind of first port of call for all kinds of other policy objectives, is start regulating tech companies. And that's going to mean that that global companies, of including American companies, are going to be enlisted in more and more attempts at policy change, all of which is going to distract them more and more from their core business, I suspect.
Matthew or Evelyn, anything to add? Great. Well, we're running towards the end of our session here, and I do want to give you each kind of a question to close us out on, which is, the permissionless approach to technology has often been credited with helping the U.S. to really be a leader, particularly in the information technology space. And when you think of many of the digital platforms, these are American companies that first come to mind. So I guess my kind of closing question to each of you is there a Brussels effect that may negatively impact the benefits of this approach? And if so, how should American consumers, innovators, and policymakers think about the impact that European and UK technology policies are having on these American companies? And Matthew, you're first on my screen, so I'm going to go to you first.
I would just ask policymakers to consider that while you might be dealing with very specific problems within your own jurisdiction, that for many, many companies, your legislation will be what they have to adapt to. So it's all well and good for a British MP to say, look, you know, we have jurisdiction in the UK and we're trying to protect British children, so we're going to ensure that these companies act in a certain way. But they should consider, I mean, two things. One is that many of these companies will feel like they're forced to adopt that sort of standard wherever they operate in order to save costs. But they should also consider, as was alluded to earlier, that a lot of less free governments will use how free countries act as an excuse for some rather nefarious activities. So I think both of those should be considered. From a sort of policy analyst, bird's eye view, I would just urge people to remember that a lot of the dynamism that we saw in the internet was in part a feature of the fact that it was, as you know, Adam Thier would say, you know, born free. When we think about what some call, you know, the stagnation of technology these days, a lot of it is in buildings or infrastructure or engineering, where there is a significant regulatory regime governing, you know, cars and drones and airplanes and these and infrastructure, these sort of things. So I think the lesson is, you know, that while there are problems to deal with, we should keep in mind the global effects, but also consider how they'll be used by governments around the world. And also remember that permissionless innovation has served us quite well in the past and shouldn't be chucked out too quickly.
Evelyn, your thoughts on this from a free speech perspective, what should Americans be aware of?
Yeah, I guess my advice to companies would be to obviously know that, you know, there's a lot of regulation coming down the pike, both in Europe and throughout the world, that will affect freedom of expression. And my recommendation is to espouse the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, which call on companies to resist when they are giving rules or pressure that is seeking to undermine freedom of expression. There are multi-stakeholder initiatives dedicated to this, like the Global Network Initiative, and many companies like Google and Microsoft participate in it to work with NGOs and others to resist this type of pressure when laws that impede basic freedom of expression norms are in sight to be passed or are passed. And I hope that companies will also use kind of these basic human rights protections for free expression to regulate their own approaches to the extent they have rules on freedom of expression too. I think by linking themselves to these global rules and not falling into the trap of thinking that regional approaches are the same thing as the global minimum standards. I mean, for Americans, I think we need to think, you know, very cautiously that these basic protections on freedom of expression were negotiated by Eleanor Roosevelt to provide minimum standards throughout the world. And companies should not abandon that lightly. They have a principled basis on which to resist some of this legislation. So that's my advice.
And Matt, finally, to you.
Yeah, look, I'd say if you look at the story of how so many kind of great digital services come to be, it's chasing big global opportunities in a really focused, energetic way. And I think that what really worries me is that that's going to become less and less the case. We're going to be in a world where those big global opportunities will be much more complex and much more bureaucratic because there's going to be so many regulatory hoops to jump through. And also that the leaders who should be building these digital services are instead going to be focused on being a regulated industry and regulatory engagement and navigating the minefield that comes with these regulations with huge potential fines attached, sometimes even like personal legal risk for the officers in these companies. And I think that all that is going to change the culture of American tech in ways which will make it less risk, making it less dynamic. And so I think US policymakers should be pushing back. I think it does have an effect when they do that. And that sense that, there's a kind of bipartisan interest in squelching tech, I think is part of why this has happened to the extent it has in Europe. But honestly, it's certainly not the only factor, right? But I think it has played its part. And I think there is just a responsibility on US companies and US policymakers to push back because, you know, what starts in Australia will go to Europe and the UK. What starts in the UK will go to Europe and will go. And then all of this will spill out into the less developed economies, which tend to follow these kind of more developed regulatory environments.
Well, thank you all. You know, we've had a quite wide-ranging discussion today, and I know there are even more topics we could get to. I want to thank our panelists for joining me this afternoon, and also thank all of our audience attendees for tuning in to today's event. We had a lot of great questions come in, and I apologize that we could not get to all of them. For those of you who may not have been able to attend live or may want to look back at some of the conversation that we had, a video recording of this event will be available on Cato's website. Thank you so much for tuning in and for being part of today's conversation.